Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and welcome to the final episode of F This Movie for 2015. This is our annual episode on the overrated, the underrated, and the ugly films of the last year. And I am joined for this special episode, as always, by the man, JB.
Ladies and gentlemen, take my advice. Pull down your pants and slide on the ice.
That means that we're starting all of our year-end wrap-up stuff. We've been doing some of it at our website, fthismovie.net. Next week, of course, will be our hotly anticipated best of show, where we talk about our favorite movies from the last year. And in the run-up to that episode, of course, we do our annual discussion of movies that we felt needed more attention, movies that maybe got a little too much attention, and movies that deserve no attention. So we will forego the usual what have you seen lately, right? Because we got a lot of movies to talk about. And in the interest of beginning on a positive note, we're going to talk about some of the underrated movies that maybe you didn't see in 2015 that we're hoping to turn some people on to. So Jay Bones, I will turn it over to you first.
Underrated.
Yep.
And clearly comedy is subjective. But I'm of the opinion that something just happened to comedy. Where are the classic comedies? When people look back 20 years from now, will there be films that are regarded like, oh, I don't know, the works of the Marx Brothers or Dr. Strangelove?
What would you say is the last, like, all-timer comedy-wise?
I don't know. I know the movie that made me laugh the most in 2015.
Okay.
Made me laugh out loud, which doesn't happen very often.
All right.
And I know the film that made me laugh the least, which we'll be talking about at the end of the podcast. But for all of its flaws, and there are several, I thought Trainwreck was really funny.
Yeah.
There were parts of Trainwreck that really made me laugh. And along going along with the same sort of theme, my first underrated film is Spy.
Okay.
Which I went into with very low expectations, although given the people involved, I should have had higher expectations, because every time I go to a film by this gentleman, I am not particularly looking forward to it. It's usually not my first choice, and I always wind up with more than I bargained for. I always feel like I got my money's worth. Is this the young man who directed Bridesmaids?
Paul Feig, yes.
And the guy who did...
The Heat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his film this year was called Spy, and it looked more like a marketing concept than a movie, but it was funny and clever, and it made me laugh a bunch of times, and it was so much better than what it could have been, which is another lazy comedy to throw on the heap.
Yeah, there was enough stuff that worked. Like, I'm not super crazy about it, only because I feel like he just doesn't put that much effort into, like, directing. That's not true. I'm sure he puts a lot of effort into it. It's just for a movie like this, I think some of the kind of action movie stuff needs to work better than it does. You look at something, you know, it's not fair to compare it to, like, Edgar Wright. But again, Edgar Wright movies are the thing and kind of goof on the thing.
And the critique of the thing, which is very difficult. Like I said before, Dr. Strangelove is effectively a very funny comedy, but a very knowing parody of the type of films that it's criticizing.
Right. And so Spy was like kind of a half successful version of that. But I agree that I wish... I haven't seen the movie yet, but every time I see a trailer for a new Melissa McCarthy movie, and I'm not a Melissa McCarthy hater, I just wish she maybe had better quality control, because I saw the trailer for this new thing she has coming out where she's like a CEO who goes to prison and then takes over a Girl Scout troop and punches kids.
It sounds like you're making it up to be a parody.
Right.
Because we were talking about this last week, that there are certain comics... I'm being gender non-specific. There are certain funny people who make their reputation in television and who seem to regard movies as this cash-in.
Yeah.
And they have, you would think that they would want the movies that they're in to not be these things that come out, they're around for 2 weeks, they make a lot of money, and then they show up on cable forever, and they're instantly forgettable, that I wish more television comics didn't regard movies as this cash cow.
Right. But yeah, Spy is better than that.
Yes.
I guess is what I'm saying. All right, my first pick is kind of a double feature, and there's a reason for that. It's a thematic double feature, and I will call it the Movie Crypt double feature, because the Movie Crypt is a podcast hosted by two filmmakers, Adam Green and Joe Lynch, both of whom had films come out this year, both of which I felt were underrated. Adam Green directed a horror film this year called Digging Up the Marrow, and Joe Lynch made an action movie called Everly, both of which came out around the same time, early this year, and got some attention, but I feel like we're better than the reception that either one got. Everly stars Salma Hayek as a woman trapped in a single apartment. Joe Lynch has described it as Die Hard in a room. and it goes to crazy places. There's a bunch of Yakuza stuff, and it becomes almost abstract at certain points. And Digging Up the Marrow is kind of a documentary-style horror film about, hey, what if monsters were real? And features a really great performance by Ray Wise. Again, I'm not arguing that either one of these is an instant classic, but I feel like both were good representations of their genres, and both were trying to do something a little bit different within their respective genres, and I wish had gotten more attention.
And because this is not my first overrated, underrated, ugly podcast, and because this is also not my first rodeo, I have brought a pen
nice.
With me
Good.
And some paper, because what I've learned is that when we do this podcast, I get a whole bunch of suggestions. Although I remember your original review of Everly,
yeah.
And I'm wondering why I haven't seen it yet.
It hasn't shown up on Netflix or anything, so...
My next underrated film is a film that I know at least a couple people associated with this movie really loved, perhaps more than I, but I didn't really think it got the attention it deserved. My feeling was it was sort of dumped. It's called Love and Mercy.
Yeah.
It's the Brian Wilson story.
Yeah.
And this is something that I wouldn't say I'm close to, but I've been a lifelong Beach Boys fan, and I've always been fascinated with the Brian Wilson backstory ever since the Bare Naked Ladies song, Brian Wilson, where if you listen to the song carefully, it makes you wonder, what are they singing about? I had a dream that I was 300 pounds, and though I was very heavy, I floated till I couldn't see the ground. So you discover that Brian Wilson has really been through it, that he had a nervous breakdown in the middle of making the album Smile, and he retreated to his bedroom where he had a sandbox installed with a grand piano in the middle of it and didn't come out for about 4 years. And Dennis Wilson used to stop by with a bag of hamburgers, and he would tell Brian, if you write us a song, I will give you a hamburger. So now he's a trained SEAL doing his tricks for fish, something they left out of the movie. But he then hooks up with this incredibly sleazy therapist who takes advantage of him, gets him to lose the weight, but he's sort of on a leash. And then he gets away from the therapist, Eugene Landy, and hopefully on to happiness. John Cusack played the older Brian Wilson, and Brian Wilson has a very distinctive voice now that he's been through it. And I at first wondered why Cusack wasn't going to do it, but watching the movie, I'm really glad he didn't, because then it would have become this weird impersonation
right.
instead of him playing this very damaged guy. And Paul Dano, who I'm not the biggest fan of, just embodies the 60s Brian Wilson,
yeah.
who had all these symphonies in his head. And I may have said this on the podcast before, because it's one of my favorite quotes of all time, at least in terms of art, that back in the 60s, before he sort of went off the rails, Brian Wilson once said that he wrote the song so that the music alone would make the listener feel loved. Wow. So it is not a film without its flaws. What I took away from it is Love and Mercy is the official version of his second wife. because she was involved and she sanctioned it, and clearly she comes off as the hero.
Right.
But the disturbing little coda that I was left with is that, very famously, Brian Wilson was sort of under the thumb of his father, who was abusive and awful. And then he moves to Landy, who's the same way. And I don't want to, I'm not suggesting his wife is abusive or awful, but it seemed like she's just the next in a line of people who, I mean,
in the film, you feel like it comes off that way?
No, no, no.
Okay.
That in the film, she's so presented as this force of right and lightness.
Right.
And if she rescued him from the clutches of Landy, then she deserves a lot of credit. It just, that was the sort of the sour note I was left with. Years and years ago, I went to a bookstore with a friend and had the bullshit Brian Wilson autobiography, Wouldn't It Be Nice, that was sort of ghost written by Landy and was really cruel to the other Beach Boys. I went to this bookstore with a buddy and got it signed, and he was just, he wasn't there. Mm. I mean, it was really disturbing to see that going on. But I think it's worth a look. I would recommend it to all of our listeners.
Yeah, I think it's really good. It's it was one of those movies that like was kind of on and off my top 10 throughout the year. And if I were to extend it to a top 15 or a top 20, I think it would be in there. I was worried going in that like, and we had had this conversation before the movie came out, like, oh, it's going to be Julie and Julia.
Yeah.
The 60s stuff is going to be great, and the modern day stuff is going to be a nightmare. And it's not that. I would argue that the 60s stuff is better for a couple different reasons.
All of the stuff where they recreate them making the records with this famous group of studio musicians is just,
it's really cool.
And very accurate, because clearly by now you have all seen The Wrecking Crew, a documentary I think I've recommended more than once on Netflix, this movie.
Yeah. An interesting kind of, it's hard to depict genius on film. And I think the movie is fairly successful at doing them. I'm hitting things on the desk because I'm so worked up.
He's emphatic about his own genius.
I think it's fairly successful at saying this guy's a genius, and kind of here's why, or here's the toll that that takes on him as well. Yeah, I think it's really strong. I really like that movie. My next pick is a movie that I don't think you liked, and some other people that have this movie did not like.
I know what it is.
You do?
I think so.
What do you think it is?
That backyard thing.
Yep. Digging for Fire, the Joe Swanberg movie, the latest film from Joe Swanberg. Again, is it great? No, but I think it's one of the better Joe Swanberg movies that I have seen. We saw it as the opening night selection at the Chicago Critics Film Festival.
And I think that colored your perception.
It may.
Joe Swanberg in attendance. He get.
Oh no, that has nothing to do with it. that has nothing to do with it.
Interesting.
I see what you did there. He had shot it. You know, his goal was to make a movie that felt like a movie. He kind of talked about it afterwards. That's the only thing that I think may have colored my perception, was maybe just understanding a little bit more of what he was doing in the film. But I was reacting to those things even before he kind of articulated that. So it's very much a Joe Swanberg movie in which not a lot happens, and a lot of the emotions are kind of very under the surface. It's mostly just kind of, you know, talky. But it's shot in a way that's kind of very cinematic. He shot it on 35, widescreen. There's this really great score, and I wish I could remember who did it, but it sounded a lot like an old Tangerine Dream score.
I agree with both of those things. It looks great, and there's a score, but now I'm picturing, like, when it, maybe it is already on Netflix, or when it,
I don't think it is.
When it goes to DVD,
yeah.
They need to use your quote at the top of the packaging. Not a lot happens. Patrick Brownlee at this movie.
It's true. Well, because again, it's a movie about a guy digging a hole in his backyard.
Yes.
But obviously the hole is, it's a symbolic hole.
Oh, is the hole like another character in the film?
That's one of my favorite moments in a movie. where Brie Larson plays a character who's this girl that shows up at Jake Johnson's house, and they kind of have a flirtation or whatever, and she's wacky and she has purple hair or whatever, and there's this scene where she's shown taking a shower, and it's not just because it's Brie Larson taking a shower, but the purple streaks are washing out of her hair and down the drain, and it's just this great kind of visual moment of like, yeah, that girl doesn't exist. That's a construct. That's a fake thing. And the purple shit in her hair washes down the drain. And she's not this quirky, you know, she's the same as your wife who you think you're bored with or something. I just think there's a lot going on in that movie. And I really liked it.
No, I like that shot too. I like the fact that Sam Rockwell shows up.
Yeah.
Playing a character that he's devised for himself. And even though it has nothing to do with the movie at hand and is this weird, he's like an alien compared to everyone else. He comes on, he does his little vaudeville turn, and then we never see him again.
The movie, he has something to do with the movie. He represents the path not taken, right? I mean, Jake Johnson could go down this road. Or he could be Mike Birbiglia, who's very funny in the movie.
Well, I have to think about that, although I thought The Path Not Taken was sort of this meta statement of Sam Rockwell represents The Path Not Taken by the movie.
I like it. Anyway, what's next for you?
My next film, I'm sure, was not enjoyed by all, and certainly, much like Digging for Fire, might have had something to do with where I saw it and when I saw it. But
I was drunk.
I can't remember the last
movie. You
not
saw
only
drunk.
Are movies too important to me, but I don't understand.
I don't think I've ever seen a movie.
I don't understand
in my
why it's like two separate things. Yeah. Like, if we're gonna get drunk, we don't need to see a movie. Right. And if we're gonna see a movie, well, then that should be the thing that's making us happy. At that, for those worlds to collide.
I would always rather see a movie than get drunk.
I don't want to be that guy. But the film is San Andreas.
I haven't seen it.
Which I thought San Andreas delivered. There was a period of time on the website where I did a series of columns about disaster movies because I love disaster movies, and I laid out the rules of disaster movies, and I'm sitting in San Andreas at the Universal City Walk Cinema in LA, and I'm there to celebrate my son's graduation, and I am enjoying the hell out of San Andreas, knowing that I, at that moment, am very close to the San Andreas Fault, and this shit could get real. It followed every rule of disaster films to a letter. Is it a great film? No, in no way, shape, or form, but I felt it delivered, which I felt a lot of the summer movies did not.
Sure. I had commented the other day on the website, because last year I had made this list of like 10 blockbusters that I think were good this year, or at least interesting, and was going to do the same thing this year. Again, it's just kind of a run-up to our best of lists, and I got to about 4 or 5, yeah. And then I ran out.
San Andreas was a shitty McDonald's meal when all you crave is a shitty McDonald's meal. And once again, on the Blu-ray packaging, this film is the cinematic equivalent of a shitty McDonald's meal. JB, F this movie.
Not much happens.
In fact, in San Andreas, too much happens.
I've said this before on the podcast, but I had avoided the movie based on the trailers because I don't like seeing movies where millions of people die and everything is destroyed for our entertainment. As much as I want to see a movie that stars Carla Gugino as The Rock's wife and Alexandra Daddario as his daughter, I just can't handle all of the destruction and the death.
A little bit less than you might think.
All right.
Although, again, that's the real, well, it's not the only scourge of CGI. But one of the worst things about CGI is they get to fill the frame. With, right. I mean, it used to be like 20 extras. And now it's like 10,000 people.
A street would just kind of shift.
It used to be 20 people screaming on the Universal backlot. Now it's half the town on fire.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I'm supposed to just care that, but The Rock is safe? All right, cool.
He got away in the helicopter. he loves his family. More than his job, apparently. Although the film bends over backwards to show you that he's not shirking his duties.
Okay, good. Now, in the In the background, at any point in the film, do we see Superman murdering the rest of those people? Anyway.
That's a film I'd actually like to see, where it's a disaster film, almost like what What's-His-Name accidentally did with the Godzilla remake that we didn't like, where there's something in the background that's supposed to be in the foreground that you're watching San Andreas, and then you notice way off in the background, who are those two people fighting and throwing themselves up against, oh my God, it's Superman and Zod.
Shared,
these two films are
shared universe.
Shared universe. Oh my God, I would love to see that movie.
I took my son to see Star Wars, and there were too many trailers beforehand.
Oh my God.
And he was really excited about Star Wars, but by trailer 8, he was like, oh, really? Like, he was getting
irritated.
Someone
commented on the site, because this was everywhere, although the trailers apparently differed by location, that someone put in the comments section of one of our things that, like, by the 6th trailer, like, people were booing. And,
oh, that was... Adam Riske said at his screening that people were turning on the theater. But the last trailer that they showed was Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice.
Ooh, not where I saw it.
And, you know, my son, he likes superheroes and he likes Batman. And I would think that he would be excited to see that trailer. But I'm watching it through his 7-year-old eyes. And I'm just like, well, this doesn't look fun to a 7-year-old at all, because it doesn't look fun to me.
That's what DC has decided in trying to ape Marvel.
No fun.
No fun of any kind. And get the notion out of your head that these were comic books.
To be fair, we haven't yet seen the movie. Maybe it'll be a ton of fun, and the marketing is just trying to promise us no fun, so the fun can be a pleasant surprise.
Will it be as fun as Man of Steel was?
Let's hope so. Let's hope so. What's next for me? Oh, a movie I can guarantee you haven't seen, called The Duff, which is a teen comedy. Duff, of course, stands for Designated Ugly Fat Friend. And, of course, they cast Mae Whitman, who is none of these things, but okay, I guess she's movie ugly or
movie
fat.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
And it was a movie that it had already been out for probably over a month, and I was, like, at a mall and felt like going to see a movie, and I was like, well, I'll go see The Duff in its last day of wide release, because I'm sure it's gone tomorrow. I was the only one in the theater, had rock bottom expectations, because I just hated the idea that this movie was trying to make Duff happen. Like, stop trying to tell us that this is a thing. It's not a thing.
It's already a thing. It's the beer on The Simpsons, so find another title.
Right. I was very pleasantly surprised by the film, which was smarter and sweeter than I expected it to be. Mae Whitman's performance goes a long way towards making the movie work, because most of the characters in the film are just kind of teen movie generic stereotypes, but she is great and makes the movie work. And as an added bonus, she's a huge horror movie nerd and has posters all over her room for zombie and shockwaves, and she's wearing t-shirts from horror movies, and so that's always fun to see one of your own kind of represented, and they don't go out of their way to, like, jam that down your throat. It's just a character detail that you really like. So I liked the movie.
And I'm glad that you're talking about it, because...
So are the producers.
I vaguely remember... when that came out, and what I took away, because sometimes I guess I'm not really paying attention, was that I thought it starred Hilary Duff.
It should have. That's just been called The Duff.
That's what I was thinking about in terms of that.
Yeah.
Would you recommend that I see it?
No.
Even for the horror movie stuff?
There's not enough of it.
Okay.
No, you're fine.
I'm going to...
Have you seen San Andreas?
I have.
Oh, all right.
I almost saw it twice.
Oh, my God.
And here's another bonus. If you're ever in L.A. and you go to Universal Studios, which is really a great place to just walk around, you don't even have to go on any of the rides. You can just walk around. The last time I was there, Jan and I walked into this corner that we had never been in before, and I look up, and the brick wall says Faber College. So they either did that as a little... Well, it wouldn't cost us that much to put that up on the wall. It's a little nod to the fact that Animal House was a Universal film. Or maybe at some point the theme park had some sort of attraction that used that wall or something. I don't know. It's very strange. It's like a place to go and sit down and eat. It's like an overflow little patio for a food stand nearby. But I had never noticed that before. I looked up and I saw Faber College. So if you're ever at Universal Studios, there's this thing next to it called City Walk with a movie theater. And because it's so close to the studio, well, it's in the studio, they often put props and costumes in the lobby. So when I saw Jurassic World, which we'll get to tonight, they had the ball sphere thing from that, and they wouldn't let you sit in it and take a picture, which I thought was a big mistake. And then in the lobby, they had costumes, which made it better. I'm going to fold the next four into one package, because I think there was a type of movie this year that I kept telling Patrick, you need to see more of these. I know you resist them like a bad kidney that your body will reject. But every time I went to see one, I was pleasantly surprised because it was both competently made and obviously intended for adults, which is becoming more and more rare. So I'm going to call...
These are the women with hat movies, right?
Not... Well, wait a minute. Well, yeah, three of them are.
Okay, yeah, see?
Oh, that women go see them with hats.
Correct.
Because the films themselves also feature women with hats.
Perfect.
So maybe
people love to see themselves represented on screen.
And I'm going to call these films adult indie bait. And I'm not talking about nonsense like...
Women with hat movies.
The exotic Marigold
right,
thing.
Right.
Here's what they are. So I went to see Woman in Gold,
yep.
Which was a serious film about a woman trying to get something back from her childhood. Well, no, come on, don't make fun of it. You haven't seen it.
I'm not. I'm
Did
not
you ever see it?
No.
I
was too busy watching The Dove.
Clearly, there came a weekend where Patrick had a decision between a film with Helen
something
Mirren.
Something for adult or something for children?
Helen Mirren or The Dove. And I think
which I thought was a movie about Hillary Duff.
I think actually that could be a documentary, Helen Mirren or The Dove. And it's a very serious intention film where she's trying to get back a painting that the Nazis stole from her family. It was 10 times better than I thought it was going to be. I'm not a fan of Ryan Reynolds. I thought he acquitted himself nicely. And then the next one is Mr. Holmes, which is a film with Ian McClellan playing the famous sleuth in his waning years. And he's having this sort of, he hires a new housekeeper and there's a mystery involved that he has to solve that has something to do with earlier books that he's written. And even though both of these films seem like something you'd expect to see on the BBC that they make well and competently, I feel that I wasn't ripped off. The third one is The Water Diviner, which actually won the Australian Academy Award for Best Picture. It is now playing on cable quite a bit. I think either Showtime or HBO.
Okay.
I saw it show up, and it's Russell Crowe. It's a war film of sorts, although it's an anti-war film. I don't want to give any of it away, but I went because it was on the IMAX screen for one weekend, and it wasn't in 3D.
Right.
That's the only reason we went.
Yeah.
And it is a big, beautiful film that's lusciously photographed and is adult indie bait. And then the fourth one, which I kept prodding Mr. Bromley to see month upon month upon month, and Sarah Silverman recently had a tweet about this last weekend, Far From the Madding Crowd, which did not attract madding crowds, and it came, and it's great, and then it left. Did you finally see it?
Nope.
Oh, boy. Now, obviously, Sarah Silverman has a horse in this race because her significant other is in it.
Oh, okay.
And is terrific, but I went with very low expectations, and it is a good story, well told, and I would recommend all four of those films. You will not feel cheated.
I have screeners for three of those, and I promise I will watch them. I promise.
I could actually give you the order in which you should see them.
Let's have it.
Given the little that
I will DVR The Water Diviner.
Given the little I know about you.
All right.
Which is actually quite a lot. You would like Far From the Madding Crowd the most.
Okay.
Followed by Mr. Holmes.
Okay.
followed by Water Diviner, followed by Women in Gold.
Okay.
I think that should be the order that you see them.
Okay.
And that would be the order of their relative quality. Although, again, it seems so rare to find a movie that treats you like a sentient adult who's been alive for several decades and can figure things out.
Here's where I'm part of the problem. Once upon a time, these movies were very common.
Yes.
It's what somebody has been referring to lately, and I wish I could give credit. The middle class for movies, you know, movies not made on a zero budget, movies not made for $100 million.
No, just the middle.
Movies for adults made with a decent budget that come out that adults used to go see. They used to be very, very, very common. They weren't events, and they weren't little scrappy indies. They were just movies.
Mainstream films.
And I didn't go see any of them. So I'm part of the problem because I want those movies to exist. And when they do come along, I'm usually pretty happy. And I say, why aren't there more of these? And then they make them and I don't go see them. So I will see all four of them, I promise.
So on the DVD case for Far From the Madding Crowd, I am part of the problem. Patrick Bromley, F this movie.
I will see this, .. I promise. my next pick is arguably my most controversial, and it won't be for you because I don't think you saw it, but it came out last January, which is always a...
the trash bin.
And I have seen it named by several critics as one of the worst films of the year, and then by a few others who want to take a stand as one of the best, and that is Michael Mann's Black Hat, which, again, is... far from Michael Mann's best movie, but I think to call it one of the worst films of the year is crazy. I guess this all depends on what metric you are judging the worst film by. And if it's like in terms of disappointment, sure. If you didn't like Black Hat, it's coming from a very talented director who, you know, clearly has stumbled. But there are too many scenes that are well photographed. I think there's too much good filmmaking in it to compare it to something like any of the number of things we're going to reference later on when we get to The Ugly. As a Michael Mann fan, and I had written a review of this back in January, and I believe I referred to it as Michael Mann porn because it is just, it's the things that you like from Michael Mann movies without a ton of substance at the center. It's just like, well, this looks like a Michael Mann movie and it sounds like one because of the music and how loud the gunshots are and it has the feel of a Michael Mann movie. I don't think it's a great story. I think some of the performances are uneven. Chris Hemsworth is trying to do a thing. I kind of think he's actually trying to imitate Michael Mann, and it doesn't totally work. But I think there's enough good there that I think if you're a fan at all of Michael Mann, it deserves to be seen.
I love it when actors do that. And obviously the most obvious example is several actors who have worked for Woody Allen have made the interesting decision to play him. But I'm even thinking of Peter Sellers has said that in Dr. Strangelove, the president of the United States is him doing an impression of Kubrick. Yeah. I love when actors make that decision. And what you're saying makes me want to see it because it's rare these days that a film is that polarizing. So when something really cuts the audience down the middle, it makes me want to see it. And it's all over cable this month.
Oh, okay.
There's cable channels showing it.
That's probably the right way to see it.
Way too often.
Yeah.
But it makes me want to see it.
Yeah.
My next underrated film is very good, and I would suggest that you see it. And I felt that it fell prey to Spielberg syndrome in that we expect his films to be excellent, and then they are, and then they go away.
Yeah.
I don't think it got the attention it deserved. Bridge of Spies is superior filmmaking.
Yes.
It is beautifully shot. It is incredibly tense. The performances, there's at least three performances in that film that need to be honored by someone.
What's the third one?
Maybe I spoke too soon.
Unless you're counting Tom Hanks twice, which I'm willing to do.
No, obviously Tom Hanks is...
Tom Hanks and Mark Rylance.
Right. Those... because he's the...
he'll be probably nominated for an Oscar.
Mark Rylance is the spy who builds the bridge,
correct?
Right? The bridge that gets blown up at the end?
What?
Oh, I'm thinking of Bridge on the River Kwai. Because the three for Bridge on the River Kwai are obviously Alec Guinness and William Holden.
Right.
And, no, I know the difference.
I know.
Bridge of Spies, you should see, and then find the YouTube clip where Tom Hanks is on the Jimmy Fallon show. Have you seen this? Jimmy Fallon's people gave some grade school kids.
Oh, just, I've seen this bit before.
Just the title.
Yeah.
It's called Bridge of Spies.
I saw one for Birdman that was pretty funny.
And they had to write the dialogue. And then Fallon and Hanks act out these, and Jan showed it to me. It's one of the funniest things I've seen all year, when you see these fifth graders trying to be so serious. And Hanks is giving it his all. Have you heard about the bridge? It's made of spies. And then it goes on from there, and it gets loonier. I don't understand, at the time that it came out, it was sort of, this is excellent, yawn.
Right,
and
right.
Because he set the bar so high,
yeah.
He can no longer top himself. And when he does something excellent, well, we were expecting our heads to explode or something like that. But you agree, it's a really good film.
It's very good. Again, speaks to that middle class. I think it probably has a higher budget than some of those other movies because it's Spielberg. And it's recreating period and whatever. But very good, very old-fashioned, very little that I can complain about. I wonder if, I mean, it was put out in October, and maybe people weren't going to the movies for that. Had it come out in December, would it be better? Would it have been buried under Star Wars? I don't know. Again, part of the problem is they wait 9 months,
right,
and then put everything out at the same time, and it's like, well, some movies are going to fall through the cracks, and it's unfortunate that this is one of them because it's a very good movie. But like you said, it does fall victim to Spielberg being expected to be great and delivering, and then like, okay.
And I give him so much credit because, in very much the same vein as Mr. Tarantino perhaps addressing current racial issues by making a film about the past, I really thought Bridge of Spies, and it really wasn't disguised. Don't we, if we as a nation are what we say that we are, if we really believe in what we claim to believe, then clearly these foreigners are entitled to the same rights in
right.
terms of trial by jury.
Right.
And all the Tom Hanks character gets is, why are you defending him?
Right.
And that should not be a question that we ever ask in this country. So I really appreciate the fact that Spielberg was not just making historical drama. He was making historical drama with an eye towards what is going on right now.
Yeah, very good. Again, if I were extending this, my top 10 list, to 15 or 20, I think that would end up on there. Because I think it's really strong. I have, I think, two more. The first one is, just kidding, I have three more. Predestination, which came out in January. It's the latest film from the Spierig brothers, who made Undead and Daybreakers, which I'm a big fan of.
Oh, yeah.
This is their latest one. Stars Ethan Hawke as a cop. It's about time travel. It's crazy in its construction. I don't even want to give anything away, but by the time you get to the end of the movie, you realize what you have seen, and it blows your mind, kind of, in terms of what the movie has done. Great performance by Sarah Snook. It's on Netflix Instant. I don't want to say too much about it, but I think people should see it because I think it's really good. And even if you don't love it, I think it's interesting and different enough from other movies. You know, I'm a sucker for time travel movies no matter what, but this movie goes to places I've never seen a movie go, and I think that alone warrants it a spot on this list.
And I'm a big fan of the filmmaker because I remember this was several years ago. I only saw Daybreakers because someone lent me the digital copy
That's
they
right.
didn't want.
That's right.
And it sat on my iTunes month after month. And then there was some night that I couldn't get to sleep. So I watched it on my laptop furtively. And obviously I'm a fan of vampire movies. And
That's a good one.
That movie knows what it's doing.
Yeah.
So I have just added that to my list. My next underrated film is a film that I feel was not only not appreciated, but not understood. And it was certainly marketed badly, perhaps at a time of year where it should not have been released at all. I may be wrong. Crimson Peak was terrific, but I would argue it's not a horror film. Or it's a horror film that's such a branch subgenre yes. of horror films that I would expect 90% of the horror audience to yawn. It's a gothic romance.
Sure.
And as that, it's terrific for about five different reasons. And I was captivated by it, and it left every other person in the United States cold.
Not me. I loved it as well. We might be the only two fans.
But you agree that it caught shit.
Oh, 100%. I fear that it's a movie for no one. Because
well, it's a movie for me.
Yeah.
Who? Oh, this is right. Because maybe I've read books in my life. It's very much like a book.
I would argue as a gothic romance, it doesn't totally work because I don't actually think a lot of the romance stuff quite lands. I think the gothic stuff, yes, 100%. And I think that's what I was responding to more than anything. I don't think it's a movie for horror fans, but I think. If you were marketing it as a gothic romance, I think those people would have been left cold by it too, you know? So I don't know who they should have tried to...
I think one of the reasons the gothic romance stuff doesn't work, and correct me if I'm wrong, the lead actor...
Tom Hiddleston?
Yeah, Thor's brother.
Yeah.
I don't think he quite captured what that part needs to capture. So from the very beginning of the film, we're aware of something that...
Well, I think the filmmakers do that a little bit. I don't know what it is. I just think maybe...
I think
maybe...
we need to be swept along, and then there needs to be a
sure.
twist.
Okay, yeah,
and,
that makes sense.
Much like there's a twist for her, but...
I thought he was really good, and I thought Mia Wasikowska was really good. I just don't think
I also like Jessica Chastain,
yeah.
who I'm not the biggest fan of.
Oh, really?
And I thought she was terrific. I
yeah.
thought, and this is becoming a cliche of F this movie... Or at least a cliche of me, it was worth going to see just for how it looked.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God.
No, I loved it, and it would have absolutely been on my underrated list were I not probably going to bring it up next week. Because I really liked it. I really liked it. And again, I recognize that it's not a... It's got problems, you know? So the storytelling, I just saw another movie like this, and I can't remember what it was. I mean, maybe The Force Awakens, where just like, I recognize that the story has problems.
Oh, sure.
But I loved living in this for 2 hours.
Yes. And so we have another Blu-ray package, a film made just for us. Patrick and JB, F this movie.
Not a lot happens.
I'm going to get around to watching this.
My next pick is a movie called Amira and Sam, which came out earlier this year from Drafthouse Films, who have become a label that everything they put out is worth seeing.
Oh, yeah.
You're not always going to love it, but it's always going to be something different than anything else. And it's a pretty conventional romance. Martin Starr plays a former... he's recently left the military and is living, I believe, in New York, working like a security job and trying to be a stand-up comic, and meets a Muslim girl, and they kind of develop a romance. And the performances are really great. It's written and directed by a guy named Sean Mullen, who I think is a former stand-up comic. This is his first film. And I think I just really responded to the performances, the love story that's very sweet, but I also think the movie has a lot more on its mind. It seems kind of on its face, just kind of a traditional romantic, not romantic comedy, I guess just a romance, but I think it has a lot to say with about how we treat each other now in our current world. There's a lot of stuff about kind of the economic crisis that's folded in, and then a lot of stuff about kind of xenophobia and I just think it's really handled really, really well. And again, this is a movie that could very easily have been on my top 10 and probably won't make it, but I think is very sweet and wonderful and worth seeing. I believe it is streaming if you have Amazon Prime. I think it's on their instant video service.
Yay, Amazon Prime.
Yay.
The other day, I was sitting in a chair, as I often am, and I was both looking at my Christmas tree and also staring out the front window. And it was very early in the morning, and I didn't have my glasses on. And suddenly, I see an Amazon box outside the window floating in the air.
For real? You and got a drone delivery?
That was my first.
You saw it?
That's the conclusion I reached. And I was like, is it on a wire? And I can't see the wire. Now, again, remember, my glasses weren't on. And it was very early in the morning, so maybe I was half asleep, and I just kept looking at it. It was just so uncanny. That's an Amazon box, and it's floating in the air. What could that be? Am I dreaming? And then I reached over and put my glasses on, and it was a reflection of a picture frame in the room, in the window. And I put my glasses on, and I'm like, I'm silly. We're still 6 months away from the packages dropping from the sky. My final underrated film is Magic Mike.
I'm sorry. I'm just XXL. Laughing at this image.
That actually happened. Magic Mike XXL,
yeah,
which had an even smaller audience than Magic Mike because all the drunk middle-aged women went to see Magic Mike and learned, oh, this isn't that.
Which is ironic because XXL is the movie they wanted Magic Mike to be.
Has more. But wouldn't you agree, it was so good,
yeah,
in so many different ways.
Yeah.
Great scenes and interesting characters. And I'm not the biggest fan of male stripping. I can take it or leave it. But I don't think it was about that.
No.
It was actually about a group of young men who are sort of struggling to make a living. And it was great. It looked great.
Yeah.
It had this sort of meandering road movie structure that you don't see very much anymore. Just like the first Magic Mike, it reminded me of a 70s movie.
Yeah.
And I mean that as a compliment.
Right, right, right.
It was really, really good, and it came and went.
Yeah, I liked it. I don't think I quite liked it as much as the first Magic Mike, but it's a very different kind of movie.
Yeah.
And I believe Soderbergh shot it, right? I think he was the DP, which explains why it looks great. I got so hung up when I saw it. When they get to that house that Jada Pinkett Smith is running, I got so hung up on, like, what is this place? It's not a strip club. It's not a brothel. I don't understand.
It's a thing that only exists in movie world.
In this movie, right.
However,
what is this place?
There are convenience stores in real life, and that scene...
Oh, that's a great scene.
...where he's just trying to get her to smile.
Yeah.
I could watch that all day long.
No, it's a great, great scene. And a lot, the movie's a lot of fun, you know, which is nice.
So if you've been taking notes, these are the movies that you need to seek out.
I have one more.
They're the movies that didn't get a lot of attention, and Patrick has one more. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. It's called The New Girlfriend, and it's the latest film by Francois Ozon. Ozon? I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. And it's a movie I don't want to say much about. I feel bad that...
Is she a robot?
So many of these movies are like, yeah, see this, but I'm not going to tell you why.
Is she a robot?
She's not a robot.
Is she a vampire?
She's not a vampire.
She a zombie?
No zombies.
That actually makes me want to see it more.
It's about the girl whose best friend dies and leaves behind a husband and a baby. And so the friend kind of steps in and tries to help out and begins to learn things about that family. And I won't say any more, but I just think it's really well done. And again, if you go in knowing nothing, goes to places you don't quite expect. Very, very interesting. There's a film currently playing that tries to cover some of the same territory, and I won't even say what that movie is, but I don't know. I don't think it's out on DVD or Blu-ray yet. I want to say it comes out in January, but when it does, I think you guys should track it down. It has a really two really, really good performances that I think are worth seeing, and I think it's a really strong movie.
Okay, those movies did not get enough attention.
Correct.
Now we turn the page to movies we would like to sweep under the rug and we're going to say some things now that are going to piss you off. You're going to be pissed shit.
I don't believe in evolution.
What?
Your turn.
Well, I don't think that's even debatable. I mean, I'm not a monkey, okay? Okay, if we evolved
from monkeys.
My dad,
also not a monkey. If my grandpa, a monkey. Sure, yeah.
But if we, Patrick, seriously.
Grandpa monkey.
If we evolved from monkeys,
yeah.
Why are there still monkeys?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Case closed.
Yeah.
Also, it's pretty cold out today.
It's
pretty cold.
Hello.
So
global warming, my dick.
Where is your global warming?
Yeah, yeah.
All these people.
Yeah.
I consider myself a person who is so, I am so clever, I refuse to be taken in by the truth. I will not be fooled by the demonstrable truth or 99% of the scientific community. I'm too bright. I don't have a lot of book learning. I have what I call street smarts. And I will not be taken in by scientific fact.
On the San Andreas DVD box, it's going
speaking
to say,
of scientific fact.
I consider myself a person, JB, after this movie.
So here are films that you should avoid.
Well, these are the overrated?
Let's do the overrated.
Yeah.
I am not happy.
Stop right there. The end.
As a rule.
Right.
I'm trying to remember the character's name. Because here's the other problem with the overrated films. Those that came out more than 8 months ago,
yeah.
I'm having a real hard time remembering them. And I even think one of these might be 2014. But you can correct me. It is so nebulous in my mind. I'm talking about the film The Theory of Everything.
That's 2014.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Well, let's just...
It won the Oscars this year, so that means it came out last year.
Okay. I'm sorry he got that condition. He's very smart, but the Academy needs to stop. With that trope.
They're not going to.
Did Jurassic World come out this year?
I want to say it did.
I would say that's overrated.
Well, okay, so that's... Again, every year I give the disclaimer that I don't like... overrated because it's us saying, like, you're wrong for liking this if you like it, which isn't what we're trying to
do.
We're
glad that anything in this world can cause happiness.
Yes.
Because the list of those things is dwindling
pretty
quick. Because if I'm to take the trailers that preceded Star Wars The Force Awakens to be true, every single one of them was the world is ending and we hate ourselves.
Right. Including the ones with Superman and Batman.
So if that's what's coming, then by all means, in your last few months of life, enjoy Jurassic World.
So I only picked two movies. One I picked because it got a better critical response than I felt was warranted. And the other was it got a better box office response than I felt was warranted. And that's Jurassic World, which I bring up because it's the most successful movie of the year as of this recording. Although I'm guessing by the end of this week, Star Wars is going to overtake
it. Change. But it's interesting that both of them are essentially playing upon the same thing to get people into the theater.
But I feel go about it very different
ways. Yes, I do too.
And the only reason I say maybe Jurassic World isn't overrated is because I think just as many people didn't like it as liked it. So I'm really just responding to the box office, which is dumb. But I stand by my initial... I saw the movie with my mom because we had seen Jurassic Park together in 1993. So I was like, well, let's go see Jurassic World together. And it ended, and I was so relieved that she didn't like it because I didn't want to be the bastard son that I usually am. And I said to her, there wasn't one thing about that I liked. And I still stand by that. I can't find anything in that movie to like.
The last movie I ever saw with my mom was Little Fockers. And she loved it.
Good.
So on the ride home, I pretended to love it,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, of course. You just say, it was cute.
I lumped Jurassic World, and I pointed this maybe too much, our award-winning podcast on Prometheus, where when the film is unspooling, it's fine, and it's occupying 2 hours of my life, and I'm enjoying it. And then the second you start to think about it, it just falls apart. It just falls apart in your hands.
Yeah. For me, both Prometheus and Jurassic World didn't work as they were unspooling. Like, I was pretty unhappy the whole time.
Hmm.
In both instances.
Well, this just shows that my brain is atrophying.
No, that's good.
Or that I'm succumbing to that syndrome that Roger Ebert did in the last 10 years of his career as a critic, that you're just so damn happy to be at the movies that it takes a little while for that to wear off. I thought the same thing about Spectre, the new James Bond film, and there is no one who is a bigger James Bond fan than I am, and I give that series a lot of latitude, but I cannot figure out how Skyfall is made, and then essentially the same team, minus Roger Deakins, makes Spectre, what, like 3 years later?
Yeah.
And I cannot understand the difference between those two films.
Spectre is a bad movie.
Yeah, for any number of reasons.
Yeah.
And yet, I was just looking at box office statistics for the year, and this goes back again to the Godzilla podcast. Apparently, all it takes to make some people happy is that James Bond is in it. So the next James Bond film will be the James Bond theme. He drives up in the Aston Martin. It's gray. Oh, it's the Aston Martin. It's gray. He gets out of the car. He's wearing a tux. He adjusts the things at your wrists. He adjusts his
cufflinks.
And then for the next 2.5 hours, he walks around the car as the James Bond theme plays.
Arguably better than Spectre.
And at the end, something in the car beeps. He says, "There's a message." He gets in the car and he drives away. That's the film. And yeah, that would break box office records because it had James Bond in it. The same way that the Godzilla reboot, people liked it because it had Godzilla in it, and the reason why people like Jurassic World, because it had fucking dinosaurs
yes,
in it.
Yes, absolutely. And I think all three of those are almost different cases. Godzilla, I think, made a lot of money because the marketing was so good, because it came out at a time of year when people were ready for spectacle. It came out early. Jurassic World is the one I can't figure out, because that did repeat business. Like, Spectre made a bunch of money because James Bond is a worldwide commodity and it makes as much or more overseas as it does here. It does crazy amounts of money and everybody saw it, but I don't know a ton of people that loved it. You know, everybody saw it because it's the latest James Bond, which I'm in favor of.
But is Jurassic World success also dependent upon its marketing, or is it very much the same sort of nostalgia that Star Wars is playing upon?
Yes. And the only reason that I say that Jurassic World I can't figure out as well, because I was going to say Star Wars is making as much money as it is, not just because it's Star Wars, which it is, but because people are going back again and again. That's the reason Avatar is the highest grossing movie of all time, because people continue to go back to it, not just saw it once. And the same is true of Jurassic World. You know, everybody went to see Jurassic World, and then half of those people went to see it again.
Really?
Because they had so much fun. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And so, again, that one I can't figure out because I was not crazy about it. But I don't think that's the case with something like Spectre. I think everybody went to see it because it's the new James Bond, and most of us came away saying, like, well, that wasn't very good.
And yet we'll be back.
Oh, 100%.
Because Quantum of Solace proves that you could do anything.
Every James Bond movie has, you know, like, we saw, it doesn't matter how bad they got.
I'm beginning to think that James Bond fans are masochists in the spirit of horror fans.
Maybe.
We'll go see.
There are enough good ones.
Yes.
To justify sitting through the bad ones.
I don't know. I got the box set for Christmas,
okay,
and I wondered if we actually sat there,
okay,
and in one hand put the discs of the James Bond films that are just irredeemably bad,
okay,
and in the other hand put the great discs, would there be more good than bad?
Oh, I'm not saying there's more good than bad. I'm saying there's enough.
There's enough good. Okay.
It doesn't need to be even a one-to-one ratio.
Okay.
I'll sit through two bad ones,
okay,
for one good one.
As will I.
Yeah, right. So, and have.
He drives up in the car.
Right.
They play the theme.
I like it.
He's in a tux. He walks,
okay,
around the car,
I like it,
for 2 hours.
And then
hours.
A 20-year-old girl says, "I love you." And he says, "I love you too."
This is my pitch.
Yeah.
And then she dies. I don't know how.
Hmm.
And then it beeps. And then he drives off.
Not bad.
That's the film.
Not bad. Weird Al Yankovic does the theme.
Oh, the title sequence is exquisite. It's the car, and it looks like the car is in a lava lamp.
I like it. Okay, so I Jurassic World was also on my list, and the other movie that I mentioned got weirdly positive critical notices, and I was once a fan of this filmmaker, and so I went to see his latest, the first of two movies he made this year, and was baffled, and that is While We're Young by Noah Baumbach.
Oh, yeah.
Which I just couldn't... I liked the ideas at the movie's center, and it's not a total disaster, but... It was a movie that was a mess in a fascinating way, and some of his crazy notions about, you know, it's supposed to be about the generation gap, and I think it gets some things right, but where it eventually goes, it becomes about ethics in documentary filmmaking.
Oh,
and I'm just
God.
Like, wait, how is this the movie? And I think some of what it has to say about documentary filmmaking is kind of interesting, but it doesn't belong in the movie where, like, Ben Stiller buys a hat.
We have another Blu-ray cover blurb. How is this the movie? Patrick Bromley F this movie. I had avoided this film for two reasons. Number one, you told me it wasn't very good. But the other reason why I avoided it is Patrick and his lovely wife are in their 30s, and my wife and I are in our 50s. So the subject matter was so dangerously close to what was happening, I was afraid the film would reveal horrible things about me.
That's not... The movie does not reflect your life in any
way.
Well,
no, I'm just saying, you can see where I would think this has the possibility of being really weird.
No. Not, I mean, maybe because I've seen the movie. I mean, the movie is very much about, like, hipsters and hipster culture.
Would it help
which I don't think
I,
we are.
If I told you that I bought a hat.
It wouldn't hurt. I almost, and I believe it's on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
I recommend that you see it because I think we could have fun talking about all of the ways it's a mess.
Because the tragedy of Baumbach is he used to make these films
yeah.
that I just loved. And
yeah.
everyone will point to The Squid and the Whale as being really a superior piece of work. And I just feel that with him, it's been diminishing returns.
Yeah, again, Mistress America, I have seen show up on top 10 lists. So people love it. I was less a fan.
And apparently, because I'm not well-versed in the work of early Preston Sturges, I cannot understand
Ernst Lubitsch.
Mistress America, which, of course, landed on my worst list.
Oh, boy. Those are my two overrated. So if you have more, we can continue overrated, and then we'll go to ugly.
Maybe just one more overrated.
All right.
Because it was seriously one of the films I was most looking forward to seeing this year. I finally got a chance to see The Big Short, which, though I think it does a very good job explaining some very complicated things very well, I can't understand why it's getting all the critical attention that it's getting. The style of the film, the way it's shot and the way it's edited is getting all this attention. I thought that was annoying and distracting and actually got in the way of the story they're trying to tell. Dana Stevens said that Steve Carell finally got this role that enabled him to shine so much more than Foxcatcher. And I see Steve Carell playing the same mope that he mistakes for serious acting as opposed to the peppy, entertaining stuff he did on The Office. On The Office, he created a character who was mortifying.
Yeah.
The first three seasons of that show, and you don't see this very much on television because television doesn't want to make its audience feel uncomfortable, his character was mortifying. And that doesn't happen very often. And in all these movies, movie after movie, why does serious acting equal mope?
I thought he was maybe one of the biggest problems with The Big Short, which, like you, I found uneven.
Especially when you see what Christian Bale is doing, which I thought was really interesting and entertaining.
Yeah, but part of me was distracted by the fact that, like, they shot him in 2 days, separate from the rest of the movie. You know what I mean? Like, he exists.
I don't know that to be true,
but, like, he exists in a separate movie from everyone else.
Plus, as opposed to a film like Apollo 13, where even though we know the eventual outcome,
right.
Ron Howard still manages to engender suspense, we know that the economy tanked in 2008.
Right.
So why do they spend so much time convincing us that their bet against the system is not going to work? We know that it does.
Right.
We know what happens.
Yeah, it was a weird approach because, again, I liked the stuff that was more kind of an autopsy on, like, here's how this happened, as opposed to trying to generate suspense.
As you pointed out, these guys... the scene about the blackjack hand,
yeah,
with Selena Gomez and the Harvard expert,
yeah,
that's magnificent.
Yeah. That was an interesting touch. What I was going to say about Steve Carell is his performance in the film reminded me of like when Michael Scott used to do improv. It's like a lot of wig and accent acting, and he just seemed out of his depth. And I like Steve Carell, but I didn't think it worked. And Ryan Gosling is getting all this attention for how great he is. I don't know. I've seen him play that swinging dick before. I don't know what is... so kind of revolutionary about what he does.
I think there's a part somewhere where Steve Carell could shine, but in the movies, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
So now this whole podcast is a descent into the netherworld.
Yeah.
And we're going to call them ugly. These are films that as they were playing on the screen, I was shaking my head. So... ham-fisted, so poorly made, so misconceived,
okay,
so poorly scripted, so poorly acted.
All right.
I think you should start.
I'll start with one of the worst movies I saw this year. It didn't even come out in theaters. It debuted on Crackle.com, and that is Joe Dirt
oh,
2
boy.
Beautiful Loser, which isn't a movie. It was, you know, a weekend of David Spade ad-libbing in a wig. Poorly
did
shot.
Happy Madison have anything to do with
you
it?
You better believe they did. And again, they had two movies come out this year, right? I believe only two.
But streaming only, which
correct.
I find very significant.
Rewarding, right? The other
we
being,
know that our audience doesn't like to leave the house because that means you have to put your pants on.
And The Ridiculous Six, which was the Netflix movie from Adam Sandler and company, probably would have landed on this list, but I felt like it was fair to only put one Happy Madison on the list, and Joe Dirt 2 is the lesser of the two.
When Adam Sandler was on Stern, I thought...
Which was a good interview.
Yeah, but one of the funniest aspects of it is Robin Quivers, Howard Stern's newswoman, is so used to watching series television... on Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
Adam Sandler had to keep clarifying.
It's a full movie.
It's a full-length
right,
movie. It's
right.
a how many episodes? No,
right.
It's a 2-hour movie. It's a movie. It's a standalone movie.
Yeah.
He had to keep clarifying that 3 or 4 times. Largely because of your reviews, even though I have Crackle on the iPad, it's free if you're willing to put up with commercials. And the algorithm by which Crackle inserts commercials... Did you watch it on Crackle?
Yeah.
And was it interrupted by commercials?
I believe so.
Did you notice it's randomly interrupted by commercials, sometimes in the middle of a line?
That
have
may
they,
have been
have
true.
They fixed that?
I was drinking a lot of poison when
well,
I was watching it.
I remember these shoes are great. And also...
No, those were the best parts of the movie.
It's often the same commercial over
yes.
and over.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh God,
yeah.
It's a test.
Yeah.
It seems designed to sell you an ad-free version of Crackle, which I don't think exists.
Maybe not.
So
and
our business model is
it.
To
right.
annoy you.
Right, yeah. Well, we give you Joe Dirt, too.
Oh,
I don't know what else to say. I mean, so many of the problems of the Happy Madison movies really crystallized for me in Joe Dirt, 2, which
they
is...
make fun of ugly fat people?
And women.
And women.
They really.
And minorities.
They really don't like women. Like, they really don't. And it's just a garbage movie that, again, is barely a movie. The end.
I was so looking forward to Tomorrowland because.
I still haven't seen it.
You might want to change your weekend plans because I am a big fan of Disney World and Disneyland. And
and Brad Bird.
Good
and Damon
Lord.
Lindelof.
No. And. It was so awful in so many different ways. As you had said, you can see the script and all the pages are different colors as they tried to re-engineer the film. And my lovely wife, who's very astute, when we walked out of it, shaking our heads, very disappointed, said, you know what the problem with that film is? Because it starts at the World's Fair, where Disney premieres the attractions that would later be in the park of Carousel of Progress, and what's the other one? It's a Small World, maybe. That you know what? It is. It's a Small World, because there's a scene in the film where It's a Small World at the World's Fair is a portal to... Okay.
Got it.
So if you're going to show us this immaculately recreated version of the past, where Disney's premiering these two attractions at the World's Fair that would be beloved, why isn't Disney a character in the film? And not like Tom Hanks in Mary Poppins is great. why not have Disney himself right. be a character in the film? It just seems like a no-brainer. And then in its last 45 minutes, it becomes every CGI-enhanced action movie ever made, where you, Laurie, is this thing that needs to be punched.
Is this a bad is this a bad robot movie? Like J.J. Abrams producing? I don't know for sure. I just remember the marketing was very... was really obscuring what the movie was even about for years. We were hearing Brad Bird is making a movie with George Clooney called Tomorrowland, has something to do with Disney, and that's all we know. And so people were supposed to go into the movie knowing nothing.
And I would argue that Clooney is actually miscast.
Yeah.
That what he's called upon to do is not what he's best at. That we're supposed to believe him as this grouchy recluse. And I...
Can we pause for a second, too, to just talk about It's a Small World? Because a couple of years ago, we went to Disney World together. Yes. And you go on the rides, and you develop sort of an internal clock for rides. And you're like, okay, I can tell that this one is winding down. This the rides are about this long, and then you get off, and you're done. It's a Small World. Goes on for such a long time.
Oh, yeah. There are many lands.
There's
there are
so many times where you're like, all right, I'm guessing we're going to be wrapping this. Nope. Still going? Still playing the song? All right, great. Oh, here it is in Chinese. Great. Okay.
Because then in the final room, and this might only be my interpretation, but I can't think that I'm clever enough to come up with this. You go through many lands, and the song It's a Small World is translated into many languages, and then you emerge in the final room where all of the children are united, and they're all singing the same song. And my conclusion is, these are dead children in heaven, that they've all died, and they're all in heaven. And so the end of the ride is really weird and creepy. And my favorite part of the ride used to be in one of the lands, and I don't think it's the heaven thing at the end, but it might have been, there was a balloon with a clown in it, and the balloon would go up and down, and the clown was holding a sign that said, help. And that that detail just stuck with me, that there's this one little ounce of disturbing tragedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Why does the clown want to get out of the balloon? What's going on there? And when they refurbished the ride the last time, which is now a couple years ago, they got rid of the help clown.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
And if anything, the movie Tomorrowland needed the help clown.
Sometimes on New Year's Eve, we rent movies that we never got around to seeing the year prior. And Tomorrowland was on my list of possibilities, as is The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which I hear is delightful, but I still have not seen.
And Man from U.N.C.L.E. is also on my worst
list. Oh, dear. All right. So we're getting to that. Awesome. Next for me is Fantastic Four, the Josh Trank reboot that, again, isn't a movie. I don't know. Hard to judge this one, I guess, because so many hands were in it and the director was possibly replaced for reshoots and they went back and redid half of it and Kate Mara's wig keeps changing and and the studio's too involved and Trank is whatever. It was just a disaster from the outset. And the thing is, I mean, you could see maybe shreds of like, oh, here's what they might have been going for, which I would love to give it credit for, but I'm not even positive that stuff works. So it's not like this was a great movie that the studio killed by having too heavy a hand. Like, I think it was a misconceived movie to begin with. It was the kind of thing that, you know, exists because the studio needs to exercise their option, basically, or else lose the rights. And, you know, we'll kind of be referenced in years to come as being a notorious disaster, and rightfully so. It's not a good movie.
And my friends, including Patrick, have told me that I'm wrong in this, but I still insist, because the Fantastic Four was my favorite comic book growing up, that I am of the opinion that it's unfilmable, that it cannot be done, that for a number of reasons, it cannot work as a movie.
I don't agree.
Well, then we're just going to wait for the movie that does it right.
James Garcia, who listens to us, has referenced before, maybe in the comments or maybe just on Twitter, has pointed out that actually The Incredibles is the best Fantastic Four movie ever made. So it can be made as a movie.
Are you suggesting that the entire thing should be CGI and not have human actors?
Perhaps.
Because that might be a way to do it. And maybe I just hold it too close to my heart because I was a little kid and that was a big part of my childhood, man.
Again, I've referenced this too many times, but when they were first doing it back when the comic book movie started to explode at Fox, and Tim Story ended up doing it, and it was also very shitty. Peyton Reed was going to do it, and he was going to do it in period 60s. And I was so on board for that, and I felt like, yeah, that has the right sensibility, because he was coming off of Down with Love, and I was like, yeah, that's how you do this movie. And so I was always advocating for that, and now Peyton Reed actually directed Ant-Man, and now I'm like not so positive that he was the guy, because I'm just not a huge Ant-Man fan. It was fine, but not great. What's next for you?
Because it was both the audience favorite and the critics favorite at the Sundance Film Festival, I went into this with very high expectations.
No, you didn't, because you saw it after hearing me say it was not good.
Yes, I had a bucket of cold water thrown over me by P. Bromley right before I sat down to watch the film. So the whole time I was watching, I was kind of wet and uncomfortable and cold. And I know that we have listeners who love this film.
Yes.
But I swear to you, I get it. It's not that I don't get it. It is just the worst, all the worst aspects of indie twee. And if this is like a meal with certain ingredients that people like, or some sort of perfume where we know if we combine these essences that people will buy the perfume, maybe that's okay. But I'm not buying the perfume. I actually thought for a while, and I kept meaning to check this out because the
You still haven't said what the movie is.
Oh. And I'm not going to. I'm going to break with tradition, and I'm going to go on and on. It's based on a book which, based on the evidence of the movie, I thought was a young adult novel. You insisted it's not young adult.
No, it probably is. I'm probably
not. I haven't checked this out yet because either. The book is literally sitting in the library where I work, and I just need to pick it up. I can't remember enjoying a film less this whole year. And part of it was because two of the characters profess to be film fans. But, as you pointed out in your review, based on the evidence in the film, they are not. Or they see films as an easy target for snot-nosed humor or something to shit on. Or, if you really want to be cynical, the filmmakers or the original author saw it as an easy way to rope in people who profess to be film fans. So Mike, the critics, and the audiences at Sundance have been patting themselves on the back that a vote for this film was them saying, I like movies too.
Maybe. So the movie is Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
And I don't know if this movie thing comes from the book or it comes from the film adaptation. You know, I'm sure that some of the people involved really felt like, well, we love film, and so we want to have these characters who love film. And maybe they came at it from a good place, but just couldn't figure out how to communicate that, because again, when you look at how the movie represents their relationship, because it says they love all these classic films and foreign films, and that automatically gives them sort of an intelligence and a depth, you know, just it's shorthand.
But then
their relationship to those movies makes no sense, and what they do with that makes no sense.
It's like in our Seventh Seal, it's a performing seal who plays a
it's
horn
just
for
stupid
fish.
Puns.
Yeah. The lowest form of humor.
And then everyone applauds them for their your little movies are great. Like, if the purpose of this is to show them being immature and then they grow by the end of the film and they say, like, oh, those were dumb and we've grown out of that.
Which I thought
They was, do a little bit.
Was that the film itself needs to acknowledge that these are two very immature boys who have found each other, and that maybe through their very real experience, not film, this is really happening and it's very serious, they sort of grow up
right.
and get over themselves and do something that's worth something, that's of some sort of quality, then I might have been on board.
Right. Again, you know, we do the disclaimer all the time that movies hit us differently, right? And so somebody completely connects with this movie and is like, oh, I love this, and we are just rejecting it outright. I saw a tweet yesterday from somebody who's verified on Twitter, so should know better. I believe he's like a former speechwriter for Obama. I don't know. Tweeted out that The Hateful Eight is the worst movie of the 21st century.
Yes, the hyperbole comment.
I can't wrap my head around that, right? I can't. And yet, we had two very different experiences watching that movie. So,
but your response immediately was, and you needed to tweet this out, although you did do a tweet that sort of referenced the tweet, but what you told me was, if you think Hateful Eight is one of the worst movies of the 21st century, then you have only seen two movies
right.
so far in the last 15 years, and neither one was The Hateful Eight.
Yeah, that opinion makes no sense to me, but just don't take it personally if we say we don't love Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, because we're glad that you do.
Because the anti-Hateful Eight backlash has begun. Mm-hmm. Apparently there are people who don't like it and think that it's boring. Now, I can brook many adjectives to describe Hateful Eight, but when you actually look at the events that happen over the course of that film, it's unfathomable to me, that someone would use that adjective. And then there's Get Hard.
Oh, yeah.
I was early, way early, because I like being early. I was so early to meet two college friends for dinner that I went to see Get Hard. That's how early I was. And I was rewarded with the stupidest, most insulting.
Yeah.
It's racist.
Very.
But it's racist in that it hates both blacks and whites.
And everyone else.
I don't understand how comedy became this. I don't understand how this ball of really angry nonsense
yeah.
became what we regard as comedy.
I don't know. Again, maybe it speaks to some of the, you know, some of the issues that we have going on that Hateful Eight is speaking to, perhaps helps birth something like Get Hard, where we don't know what to do with our racial divide in this country or the tensions that exist. And so it births this weird, angry comedy that just is meant to sort of unite races, but is very racist in doing so and traffics in only stereotypes. There's a scene where if I was making a list of the worst moments in movies this year, I would include this scene where Kevin Hart plays a bunch of characters on a prison yard.
Yeah.
And it's clearly set up as this tour de force comic thing where he's changing characters and every one of them is a racist stereotype in a terrible way. It's an ugly movie that wants us to laugh at ugly things.
A big parade of awful.
Yeah. My next movie is Terminator Genesis,
which was also on my list.
What do we say? It's a shit pile. It's, you know, there's movies that we are reaping what we sow, right? Because we demand that movies go back to the things that we love. We want a new Indiana Jones. We want a new Star Wars. Bring back Full House. Bring back Wet Hot American Summer. Bring back.
And it's interesting because there's so much talk in our society about entitlement. That I want another Indiana Jones movie. The answer is no.
Right. Yes.
No.
Yes.
Because there's this washcloth called the Terminator.
Mm-hmm.
And we have wrung
right.
it out.
Right.
It is thoroughly wrung out. But maybe there's one more drop. No.
Right.
No. It's a dry, sad cloth.
I'm a fan of Terminator 2. I mean, I love the first one. I'm a fan of Terminator 2.
I think Terminator 2 is one of the best action movies I've ever seen, and I think you can speak to this, because sometimes I forget how old you really are, or young. Did you see that in the theater when it came out?
A few times.
The special effects were, no one had ever seen that before.
Yeah.
And I would argue they still hold up.
Oh, I would too. Yeah, absolutely. And again, the movie has some storytelling dialogue problems because, you know, James Cameron. But I think it's great. I would argue that at that point, the series needed to end.
Yes.
Because every subsequent sequel has just been sort of a reworking of the themes present in the first film, which, I mean, even the sequel is, but at least it changes things up a little bit. You know, Terminator Genesis ends up making money overseas, especially because, well, we like the Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger's a movie star. It's got special effects. Let's go see it. So the movie is not the disaster financially that we think it is in America.
So there'll be another one?
There could be. I don't know, again, because every once in a while, studios say, like, well, wait a second. People really seemed to hate this. Let's slow down a second. Because, of course, this was conceived as the first part in a new trilogy, because that's the only way we can think about movies or talk about movies now. And I'm sure they put the brakes on that. Now, will there be another one? Perhaps, but I don't think it's going to be part two of Terminator Genesis.
My thought is Arnold dies, which I certainly don't want to see happen, but we all die someday. Arnold dies, and then they make a film called The Terminator's Coffin. That's all about that. This is another example of that there's art and there's commerce. And what drives Hollywood crazy is that there has to be the art part, because if you're making baked beans, you keep making baked beans, and people like baked beans because, goddamn, they're delicious, especially if you're in the mood for baked beans. And there's a consistent quality to the baked beans. What you're describing sounds exactly like that. I want more baked beans. Well, movies aren't baked beans.
Right.
But I want the robot guy.
And again, everybody sets out to make a good movie. People don't set out to make shit, but along the way, shit happens, and Terminator Genesis is shit. It is big budget Hollywood product at its worst. Yeah.
This is a moment of silence for the creative spirit. But there's also hope. A new hope.
Right?
Because next week we're going to talk about
our favorite movies.
The favorite movies of the year, because, correct me if I'm wrong, this was a terrific year for movies.
Lots of good stuff.
A bounty.
Yeah. And again, maybe a lot of it didn't exist on that big budget Hollywood product level, but there's a ton of good stuff. A ton of good stuff. Anything else on your worst list?
No.
Oh, you're done?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I thought you had more.
No.
You didn't want to talk about Mistress America at all, or?
Well, obviously,
Man from Uncle,
as you said.
Movies you referenced.
If people went to see them and were entertained, I'm glad that it served a purpose in your life. But I was also a big fan of Man from U.N.C.L.E. when it was originally on TV. And I just thought the movie was like cotton candy. It was there and it looked nice and things happened. And then you leave the theater and it completely falls apart.
Yeah.
And when you compare Mistress America, I would even argue when you compare Mistress America to Frances Ha, I think Mistress America comes out short. It almost felt as if they were making it up as they went along.
And perhaps they were.
That lengthy sequence when they're all in the house. And it's,
well, that's the screwball thing where it all comes together, right?
Right. But again, as we've discussed before, the last time was with Just Go With It. There are rules for the farce.
Right.
And it's not enough to just get all these different people in a house.
Right.
There's a way to do it. Yeah. And I'm not putting myself above the filmmakers. I just thought it came across as lazy and uninteresting.
Sure. I liked the lead performance by, I believe her name is Lola Kirk, and enough that it wasn't one of the worst films for me, but it was disappointing. You know, Noah Baumbach, a filmmaker I used to really like, made two movies this year that disappointed me, I guess. I have three more that I'll talk about quickly. The first is 50 Shades of Grey. which again made all of the money and is a big piece of shit, adapted from a big piece of shit, and I cannot understand why it is so popular. I'm sure there are very easy reasons. I'm glad that films were made this year that attracted large female audiences, large African-American audiences, because perhaps it means studios will begin thinking of those audiences and making more of those films. So if 50 Shades of Grey is good for the business, great. I just don't want more movies like 50 Shades of Grey, which is a really shitty movie with one decent performance by Dakota Johnson and one terrible performance by the guy. I don't even know his name. Poorly made.
And it seemed to me, and I haven't seen it, but I remember the phenomenon that was the book, and it seemed to be a continuation of what film crit Hulk noticed in the Twilight series, that the underlying message of 50 Shades of Grey is, one, the most important thing in the world is to have a boyfriend, and two, if he's mean to you and controlling, that means he loves you, which is two messages I don't think women should want in their heads.
And the movie ends in a place, I don't want to spoil the ending of 50 Shades of Grey.
It ends in a place, does it end in her butt?
That's 50 Shades Darker, which is coming next. Very much like 9.5 Weeks, which is sort of about a woman realizing, like, hey, I don't need this shit. But then the movie walks that back because we have to make two more of them because they wrote two more books. So let's get in the way of what we've been trying to accomplish thematically and in terms of the character development, because commerce takes the front seat. We got to make two more of these. So let's take back the one empowering decision this character makes, because, well, they have to end up together. I don't know if they end up together in the sequels, but.
And you've seen the movie.
I have.
And I will admit that I haven't. Is there also this strain of, if a guy with no money was doing this, it would not be seen in the same way?
100%.
That it's that
fucked up.
That it's wealth porn.
It's very fucked up. It's very fucked up about what it says. Its popularity, to me, is fucked up in terms of what it says about what its fans feel is lacking, or what the kind of wish fulfillment that they want to see played out, either in the book or on the screen. The enormity of its popularity, to me, says something very disturbing. But whatever. Two more. One is Chappie, which is just a fucking mess.
I'm sorry, I skipped down because I put worst 2015 in all caps.
Okay.
And then Chappie, because it's an acronym in all caps. That's my worst film of the year.
Oh,
that's
for real?
Worse than Tomorrowland.
Oh, okay. It's a mess.
And part of it was my expectations going in were so high because of his first film.
Yes. His second film was not great. His latest film is even worse. Again, it has some ideas. It has some ambition. The Chappie special effect is very good. Those are the positive things I can say. There's nothing else. The movie is just so crazy ill-conceived.
It was so many months ago, I've kind of forgotten.
It was almost a year.
How to do it. But we brought it up.
Oh, my gosh.
And what have you seen lately? And I brought up that there was he reaches this repetitive speech cadence that really got on my last nerve.
And Dennis Atherton, I think, said he made it his ringtone. Now, I'm not positive that he's being serious.
And but I did my version of it, which was very popular with some
right.
of our listeners.
It's Dennis Atherton's ringtone. And then the last movie I'll mention is one that nobody saw or heard of, and it's a movie called Muck. And it is a,
he's making this one up,
it's
ladies
a
and
horror
gentlemen.
Film, and the title couldn't review itself any better. You will not see a worse. A lot of these other movies that we're talking about, Dakota Johnson gives a good performance in 50 Shades of Grey. Chappie has some ambition. Mistress America has a great Lola Kirk performance.
There's a germ of an idea.
There are things to
in
like
in Tomorrowland, and a female performance that could have been something.
Things to like. When I talk about the worst movies, I'm talking about, like, Muck is so poorly photographed you can't see most of it because it's so dark. It hates women and films them all like Playboy centerfolds. It's a horror movie that offers none of the things that you go to horror movies for. It is truly, truly the worst movie I saw this year.
Rule one for filmmakers, audiences like to see what is going on, what is being photographed.
It's just a piece of shit that should always be avoided, and I believe conceived as the first part of a trilogy.
And we
because
have
the other two are already in the works, including a prequel.
Muck 2?
Before Muck.
Muck 2, colon, fuck you.
Yeah.
I think we have our final Blu-ray case of the podcast. The Blu-ray case for Muck. You can't even see what's going on, Patrick Brownlee.
Not a lot happens, .. At least I don't think. I'm not sure. I couldn't see.
But no, what the filmmakers will take is, at the very top of the box, Playboy centerfolds. Patrick Brownlee, F this movie.
Anyway, so there's our overrated, underrated, ugly. A lot of movies you should see.
I'm going to publicly state that if anything we said made you angry, I'm sorry, but personally, I'm sitting here thinking, I'm really happy if that happened, because if you're angry, you're alive.
Next week, we're going to do our top tens. And as always, you can find us at fthismovie.net. Follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. Like us on Facebook. Listen to us on Stitcher. Or hear us in the iTunes store. Leave a review if you like the show. Please say nice things. Only if you like it. If you don't, you know, keep it to yourself. Anything else?
I think that's it.
Happy 2015, everyone.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.